tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. We are moving on to part 34 of our continued reading of Henry Ford's four-volume set, The International Jew. I am your host, Ted Midward, and this is RadioAryan.com. On the last episode, part 33, we got into the Jewish characteristics and Jewish fingerprints all over the liquor trade during the days of Prohibition. And today, our first half of the episode is going to, I think, wrap up on that issue and then perhaps move on to another topic, another subject in the second half. We'll see here. But first, the very first article we will start with today is entitled, "The Jewish Element in Bootlegging Evil." A student of the liquor history of the United States is left wondering, not that Prohibition came, but that the authorities ever allowed matters to go so far as to compel the people to take the issue into their own hands. That is the point where those who believe in personal liberty and those who believe in public safety ought to meet each other. It cannot be contended that every believer in Prohibition is a crank, nor can it be contended that every believer in personal liberty is a drunkard or a liquor guzzler. Each of them stands for a principle, that is, a principle of right. But the prohibitionist has been able to command victory over the personal liberty advocate because the stuff that the prohibitionist is against ought not to be sold nor used under any circumstances, whereas the stuff the personal liberty advocate thinks he favors is not the stuff he thinks it is at all. If the element in question were poisoned toothpaste, we do have poisoned toothpaste, or opium, or any other conceitedly dangerous substance, both the prohibitionist and the personal liberty advocate would agree. What the honest personal liberty advocate needs to learn is that the liquor, which caused the adoption of Prohibition, was most dangerous to the individual and society. The question was not one of liberty, but of safety. Well, let me stop and comment here. We're early on and I'm already stopping to comment. Imagine that. Alcohol is, I think most people understood it, and kind of like for the old Western movies, when you walked into a saloon, the bartender asked you, or said, or declared, pick your poison. Alcohol is a poison to our human system, our human bodies, is it not? We don't think of it that way. We think of it as our right to, like Henry and his editors are saying here, we think of it as a liberty, as a privilege, as an allowance, something that is there for a good time. And kind of like smoking, we really ignore the toll that it takes on our health and how dangerous it truly is. Anyway, continuing on. It is scarcely to be hoped that all the personal liberty groups will come to agree with this, because most of them are formed of the very men who made and profited by the drugged and chemicalized substances which were sold over the bar and in bottles. Liquor men themselves must agree with the facts. Even Bonfert's Wine and Spirits Circular admitted years ago that the bulk of spirits sold today in glass under well-known brands is not what it is represented to be. The truth of the matter is, we dislike to say it, the wine and spirit trade of this country is honeycombed with fraud, and the most radical measure should be applied, and applied vigorously. Many a dealer prominent socially, morally, religiously, and in philanthropic circles will take a lot of neutral spirits, only a few days old, flavor them with a little heavy-bodied whiskey, and brand them on the label or glass with the name of any state or country desired and with any age, and this he will do with all smiles and glee and inward delight that is said to characterize the bold buccaneer when he cuts a throat and scuttles a ship. These excerpts show how near the official publications of the liquor trade could come to describing the practice and indicating the Jew. The last quotation was a direct hit at Louisville Liquor Jews, one of which compounders furnished a room at the YMCA of that city, another of whom adorned the town with public gifts, all of whom are Kentucky colonels, though their ancestry is not exactly Kentuckian nor even American. The wine companies of Ohio, whose vineyards on Kelly's Island and elsewhere had built up a standard business, joined in the protest. They pointed out that counterfeit wines were flowing out of factories in Cleveland and Cincinnati, while the legitimate wine districts of Sandusky and Put-in Bay were being saddled with the stigma of poisoned goods. As all the counterfeit business was in the hands of the Jews, the statement is unavoidable that the whole movement of degradation of liquor was Jewish. Then came Prohibition. The Constitution of the United States was amended, the amendment being ratified by 45 states. The issue had been actively before the nation longer than any other issue except the slavery question, so that the people's action on it must be regarded as deliberate, and the liquor business was legally ended. But what was the Jewish attitude toward prohibition while it was being argued before the nation? What has been the Jewish attitude toward prohibition since it has been adopted? Both these questions can be answered the same way. There are, of course, Kentuckians and others who have convinced themselves that the Jewish compounders foresaw prohibition and welcomed it because they saw it would increase their profits 1,000%. But whatever the truth of that may be, there are no available records to support it. The Jews destroyed the business, that is true. But whether intentionally, for greater illegitimate profits, we cannot say. There are, however, records of Jewish activity during the Reform agitation. The Jews were against prohibition. Their press and pulpit were against it. Their whole influence in politics and finance were against it. They were the backbone of the entire wet, as they called it, propaganda, and are today. The great temperance organizations will tell you that Jews did not contribute to their work. One national prohibition organization admits a gift of $5 in many years. Will Irwin, investigating the early prohibition movement in the South for Collier's Weekly in 1901, found that the Modern Voice, a Jewish religious weekly which is still published, was engaged in carrying the wet propaganda into the southern states. The Modern Voice lost more votes than it made for its lack of taste in printing a half-tone picture of Christ endorsing the liquor traffic. J.K. Baer, one of the editors of this Jewish paper, explained his activity in this direction by saying, "We are a Jewish weekly, and the Jews are opposed on moral grounds to prohibition." Mr. Rosenthal was associated in the work. This was typical of the Jewish press everywhere. The Jewish stage was enlisted, every man and every girl, just as it is now, to deride those who protested against the destruction of the American people by counterfeit whiskey and wine. Jazz music, the movies, fake medical experts, every agency under Jewish control was mobilized to assist the fight for a continuance of the privilege of drugging the people's drink. This will scarcely be denied, at least by Jews. Some Gentile fronts may feel obliged to rush to the defense of the Jews by denying it, but their work is unnecessary. Jews themselves make no bones about it. They did not favor prohibition, but they did not fear it either. They knew that they would be exempt. They knew that it would bring certain illegitimate commercial advantages. They would be winners either way. Jewish luck. Controlling both sides, profiting from both sides, folks. That's, boy, what luck. Continuing on. It's not surprising, therefore, that violation and evasion of the prohibition law has had a deep Jewish complexion from the very beginning. The Dearborn Independent would be glad to be excused from making the raw statement that bootlegging is a 95% controlled Jewish industry in which a certain class of rabbis have been active. We, therefore, avail ourselves of the report of an address of Rabbi Leo M. Franklin of Detroit, president of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, as given before that body at Washington in April 1921, confirming the general fact with this excerpt. And this is a lengthy, oh boy, this is about 6 or 7, maybe even 8 paragraphs. Okay, here we go. In making the recommendation I gave you in my message in regard to this matter, and in going to the extreme in suggesting that we appeal to the government to rescind that part of the prohibition law which gives rabbis permission to issue permits for the purchase and distribution of wine for ritual purposes, I did so after very mature consideration. I am sure that after his successor shall have been in the chair of the conference for any length of time, he will come to exactly the same conclusions as I did. You gentlemen, members of this conference, who have dealt with this situation as a local question, have had, here and there, some small question to solve. But when you become president of the conference and have letters from every part of the country, almost day by day, asking you as president of the conference to give the necessary authority to all sorts of men in all sorts of conditions to purchase and distribute wine for ritual purposes, then you will take a different angle on this whole situation. I pointed out to one of my colleagues, next to whom I was just now sitting, that within the past month I have received requests from 3 different men calling themselves rabbis in their communities for authorization to purchase and distribute wine. I know that I am not exaggerating when I say that during this last year I received requests from not less than 150 men in all parts of the country for permits to distribute wine. I had the applicants investigated, and I may say to you that in 9 cases out of 10, we found those who were attempting to use this conference through its executive officers for the obtaining of this authority were men who had not the slightest right to stand before their communities as rabbis. What were they for the most part? They were men without the slightest pretense at rabbinical training or position who, for the purpose of getting into the wholesale liquor business, if you will, organized congregations. Nothing on God's earth could prevent them from doing so. They simply gathered around them little companies of men. They called them congregations. And then under the law, as it now exists, they were privileged to purchase and distribute wine to these people. And I call your attention to the fact that many of the so-called members of these congregations were not members of one congregation only. There's laughter in the crowd as he's saying this. This is not a laughing matter. There were not only members of one congregation, but members of 2, 3, 4, and upward. Why, You don't know what good Jews many have become since this law has gone into effect. What is more, gentlemen, perhaps some of you don't realize what popularity has come to the sermon and how many Jews have suddenly come to realize the beauty and the duty of the Kiddush on Friday night. I tell you, it is a mighty serious problem, and, say what you will, our conference, under present conditions, is being used as a medium by unscrupulous men, by the dozens and by the hundreds, to carry on a bootlegging business in the name of religion. Now you say there have been just small scandals here and there. A wine company in New York was raided last week, and $250,000 worth of wine was taken away by the authorities, supposed to be for ritual purposes. Don't forget that rabbi after rabbi, last week in New York, a few of whom I happen to know, and in Rochester, Buffalo, Flint, Michigan, and Port Huron, Michigan, in any number of small towns throughout the country, if you have read your papers carefully, you will find that Rabbi so-and-so has been arrested as a bootlegger. That's the end of the speech given at the Conference of American Rabbis. Back to the main text. The discussion of this subject by the other rabbis present was very interesting. There was a request that personal experiences be debarred, but some crept in. Rabbi Cohen, for example, was quite explicit, saying, "Being one of those who oppose the whole prohibition law, I am not in sympathy with the whole prohibition law. It seems to me that we rabbis ought not to stand in the way of our own members in their legitimate ways of getting wine for their homes. If a member wants the wine, I would like to be in a position that he may have the wine, even though he may not absolutely have to have it." Rabbi Cohen here pronounced the typical Jewish view. If the Gentiles want to prohibit themselves from having liquor, let them do it. But if there is a loophole for the Jews such as the rabbinical permit offers, it should be used generously for any member, even though he may not absolutely have to have it. The pre-prohibition Jewish liquor business is also the post-prohibition Jewish liquor business. That fact is established by mountainous evidence. This does not mean, of course, that every bootlegger you meet is a Jew, nor that you will ever meet a Jew serving as an itinerant bootlegger. Unless you live in Chicago, New York, or other large cities, an actual meeting with the Jew in this minor capacity will not be frequent. The Jew is the possessor of the wholesale stocks. He's the director of the underground railways that convey the stuff surreptitiously to the public. Seldom does he risk his own safety in being the last man to hand the goods to the consumer and to take the money. But notwithstanding all the carefulness, the bulk of the arrests made in the United States have been among the Jews. The bulk of the liquor permits, a guess at 95% would not be too high, are in the hands of Jews. More and more, the Jews are being appointed as prohibition enforcement officers at the central points of distribution. It is a fact, as Rabbi Franklin showed, that part of the trouble arises over the abuse of what has been called rabbinical wine. But, big as it seems by itself, it is really a small part in comparison with the whole. Numbers of lesser rabbis have profited from the sale of liquor, no doubt of that. And not only among their own people, but from any people making the demand. "If you sign a Jewish name, you can get it," is the watchword. Newspaper offices have been kept wet, in some cases, by rabbinical wine, which accounts for the dribble of wet propaganda in the so-called humorous and other columns of the evening journals. It happens that rabbinical wine is a euphemism for whiskey, gin, scotch, champagne, vermouth, absinthe, or any other kind of hard liquor. The stocks that existed when prohibition went into force have not only deceased, but have actually increased because of the increase in the doctoring of the stuff. It has been cheapened, its bulk has been increased, and it has been made, if anything, more deadly than before. As fatal as bootleg whiskey, that's a saying founded on thousands of deaths. The wholesale stocks of compounded liquor remained in the hands of the men who owned them, while the retail stocks in stores and saloons had to be disposed of. That was one of the first big mistakes, that the little fellow was compelled to get rid of his stock, while the big fellow was permitted to keep his. The so-called rabbis, who had advanced information of the special privileges which the Jews were to enjoy under the Prohibition Law, were very active in buying up these smaller stocks and storing them away. Of course, no one could prevent them. Was it not ritual wine? Even though it was any kind of liquor, it went under that cover name of ritual wine. And of course, as everybody knows, great scandal resulted. Protests like that of Rabbi Franklin indicate that a part of Jewish public opinion resents the policy of exempting Jews from the Prohibition Law, but this is minority opinion. What the Central Conference of American Rabbis may think is of little consequence to the mass of Jews in America. The people to scrutinize with regard to this is not the Rabbi Franklins, who are amenable to the significance of American opinion, but those Jews who do not consult with American rabbis but run the political end of Jewry as they choose. There is no reason why the Jews should be exempt from the operation of the Constitution of the United States at all, yet the Constitution is suspended in their favor when the 10-gallon permit is given. But it would be a great mistake to suppose that there is or could be any objection to the Jews' ritualistic use of wine, or that the present scandal with regard to law violation rises from that. It is not a religious question at all. It is purely a commercial question. The people who are breaking the prohibition law are the same people who broke the pure food law with regard to the ingredients of whiskey. They are essentially a law-breaking class. That's right. They've adulterated and impurified and mongrelized, I guess, essentially, so to speak, alcohol making in the United States. When it was in the hands of the Gentile Christians, it was treated with respect. It was given time to be made pure, to be made whole. And when the Jews got their hands on it, they've totally adulterated the entire process. I guess that's so true. These people do not follow the Old Testament laws. That's certainly true. Continuing on, the Gentile boobs who patronize bootleggers today are being sold a liquor that is never what it is represented to be, in spite of names blown in the bottles. The most conscienceless fraud is being perpetrated on gullible people at an increase in profit from 400 to 1,000%. The stuff brought from Havana is Jew whiskey shipped there, doctored still more, and then shipped back at increased prices. The Gentile boobs, fancying they're getting something extra special, just brought in from Havana. Oh my goodness. 20 years ago, Jewish liquor dealers of Chicago were using genuine James E. Pepper bottles refilled with vile ingredients compounded in back rooms. 20 years ago, there were counterfeit whiskeys sold in the U.S. bearing forged Canadian government stamps. The forgers of the labels were Jewish liquor houses. 20 years ago, there was unlimited faking of liquor labels. A Chicago printing house furnishing Jewish liquor houses with clever imitations of any reputable label in use. Foreign, American, and Canadian labels were unscrupulously adopted and brazenly advertised everywhere. These abuses did not wait for prohibition. They were daily Jewish practices 20 years ago. The only difference now is that the stuff which is sold is still worse. The enforcement of the prohibition law ought to be rigidly complete, for the same reason that the enforcement of the pure food law should have been complete years ago. It's necessary to prevent the wholesale harming of an ignorant public. The maintenance of the idea of drink in the minds of the people is due to Jewish propaganda. There is not a dialogue on the stage today that does not drip with whiskey patter. As all the plays making much noise this year are not only Jew-written, Jew-produced, and Jew-controlled, but also Jew-played. The stages swarm with Jewish countenances this year. The drip of whiskey patter is constant. If theatergoers were at all observant, they would see that most of their money goes to support pro-Jewish propaganda in one form or another, which is, of course, a tribute to Jewish business genius. What other people could embark on a pro-racial propaganda and make the opposite race pay for it? This idea of drink will be maintained by means of the Jewish stage, Jewish jazz, and the Jewish comics until somebody comes down hard upon it as being incentive of treason to the Constitution. When a Jewish comedian can indulge in a 15-minute monologue panning the United States, defaming liberty, heaping contempt upon the pilgrims, and openly praising a violation of a portion of the Constitution of the United States, and when choruses sing this sort of thing, slapstick artists take it up and it becomes evident that the country is being ringed around every week by repeated attacks upon what the people have established, it is certain not to be very long before a heavy hand will be laid on the whole business. The Department of Justice should pay some attention to the treason nightly spouted on the legitimate stage before Americans who pay as high as $5 each in support of the propaganda. First and last, the illicit liquor business in all its phases, both before and after Prohibition, has always been Jewish. Before Prohibition, it was morally illicit. After Prohibition, it became both morally and legally illicit. And it is not a cause for shaming among the majority of the Jews, sad to say. It's rather a cause for boast. The Yiddish newspapers are fruitful of jocular references to the fact, and they even carry large wine company advertisements week after week. As before Prohibition, the key to the steady degeneration of the liquor business was the fact of Jewish domination. So now the key to the organized and lawless rebellion against a recently enacted article of the Constitution is also Jewish. Prohibition enforcement officers will find a shortcut to successful enforcement along this line, and if law-abiding Jews would help with what they know, the work could soon be accomplished. That's the end of the first half of today's episode. This was published in the Dearborn Independent on December 31st, 1921. Okay, we're moving on to the second half of today's episode. This next article is entitled Angles of Jewish Influence in American Life. The Jewish question exists wherever Jews appear, says Theodore Herzl, because they bring it with them. It is not their numbers that create the question, for there is, in almost every country, a larger number of other aliens than of Jews. It is not their much boasted ability, for it is now coming to be understood that, give the Jew an equal start and hold him to the rules of the game, and he is not smarter than anyone else. Indeed, in one great class of Jews, the zeal is quenched when opportunity for intrigue is removed. You know what? Let me stop and comment. We still have this 100 years later. We have this stereotype that Jews are smarter than everyone else because of how financially successful they are here in America as a group. And that's nothing could be really further from the truth. They work together as a group. They have special privileges when it comes to affirmative action and racial quotas, which they benefit from and which they punish whites with. The national average IQ of the state of Israel is not anything special. I think it's maybe barely over 100, if it is even over 100 points. There's nothing special about them. The fact is that as a group, they work together, they network in a sort of nepotism, and they're able to break the rules and get away with it and not have the law enforced upon them like the average Gentile is. So we still have this today. Continuing on with the text. The Jewish question is not in the number of Jews who here reside, not in the Americans' jealousy of the Jews' success, certainly not in any objection to the Jews' entirely unobjectionable Mosaic religion. It's in something else. And that something else is the fact that Jewish influence on the life of the country where Jews dwell. In the United States, it is the Jewish influence on American life. That the Jews exert an influence, they themselves loudly proclaim. They brag about it. Brag about it all the time. How successful they are. How much power and control they have. Continuing on. One is permitted to think that they really claim a stronger influence than they possess, especially in those higher regions where excellent and determinative influences have been at work. The Jews claim, indeed, that the fundamentals of the United States are Jewish and not Christian, and that the entire history of this country should be rewritten to make proper acknowledgement of the prior glory due to the tribe of Judah. If the question of influence rested entirely on the Jewish claim, there would be no occasion for doubt. They claim it all. But it is kindness to hold them to the facts. It is also more clearly explanatory of conditions in our country. If they insist that they gave us our Bible, and gave us our God, and gave us our religion, as they do over and over again with nauseating superciliousness throughout all their polemic publications, not a single one of these claims being true, they must not grow impatient and profane while we complete the list of the real influences they have set at work in American life. It is not the Jewish people, but the Jewish idea, and the people only as vehicles of the idea, that is the point at issue. As it was Prussianism and not the German people that was the objective in the recent war, so in this investigation of the Jewish question, it is Jewish influence and the Jewish idea that are being discovered and defined. The Jews are propagandists. This was originally their mission. But they were to propagate the central tenet of their religion. This they failed to do. By failing in this, they, according to their own scriptures, failed everywhere. They are now without a mission of blessing. Few of their leaders even claim a spiritual mission. But the mission idea is still with them in a degenerate form. It represents the grossest materialism of the day. It has become a means of sordid acquisition instead of a channel of service. The essence of the Jewish idea in its influence on the labor world is the same as in all other departments: the destruction of real values in favor of fictitious values. The Jewish philosophy of money is not to make money, but to get money. The distinction between those two is fundamental. That explains Jews being financiers instead of captains of industry. It is the difference between getting and making. The creative, constructive type of mind has an affection for the thing it is doing. The non-Jewish worker formerly chose the work he liked best. He did not change his employment easily because there was a bond between him and the kind of work he had chosen. Nothing else was so attractive to him. He would rather draw a little less money and do what he liked to do than a little more and do what irked him. The maker is always thus influenced by his liking. Not so with the getter. It doesn't matter what he does so long as the income is satisfactory. He has no illusions, sentiments, or affections on the side of work. It is the geld that counts. He has no attachment for the things he makes, for he doesn't make any. He deals in the things which other men make and regards them solely on the side of their money-drawing value. The joy of creative labor is nothing to him, not even an intelligible saying. Now, previous to the advent of Jewish socialistic and subversive ideas, the predominant thought in the labor world was to make things and thus make money. There was a pride among mechanics. Men who made things were a sturdy, honest race because they dealt with ideas of skill and quality, and their very characters were formed by the satisfaction of having performed useful functions in society. They were the makers, and society was solid as long as they were solid. Men made shoes as exhibitions of their skill. Farmers raised crops for the inherent love of crops, not with reference to the far-off money markets. Everywhere the job was the main thing, and the rest was incidental. The only way to break down this strong safeguard of society, that is, a laboring class of sturdy character, was to sow other ideas among it. And the most dangerous of all the ideas sown was that which substituted get for make. With the required manipulation of the money and food markets, enough pressure could be brought to bear on the ultimate consumers to give point to the idea of get. And it was not long before the internal relations of American business were totally upset, with Jews at the head of the banking system and Jews at the head of both the conservative and radical elements of the labor movement and, most potent of all, the Jewish idea sowed throughout the minds of working men. What idea? The old idea of get instead of make. The idea of get is a vicious, antisocial and destructive idea when held alone. But when held in company with make, and as second in importance, it's legitimate and constructive. As soon as a man or a class is inoculated with the strictly Jewish idea of getting, like, getting mine, get in while the getting is good, honestly if you can, dishonestly if you must, but just get it. All of which are notes of this treasonable philosophy. The very cement of society loses its adhesiveness and begins to crumble. The great myth and fiction of money has been forced into the place of real things, and the second step of the drama can thus be opened up. Jewish influence on the thought of the working men of the United States, as well as on the thought of business and professional men, has been bad, thoroughly bad. This is not manifested in a division between capital and labor, for there are no such separate elements. There is only the executive and operating departments of American business. The real division is between the Jewish idea of get and the Anglo-Saxon idea of make. And at the present time, the Jewish idea has been successful enough to have caused an upset.
All over the United States, in many branches of trade, communist colleges are maintained, officered, and taught by Jews. Those so-called colleges exist in Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Rochester, Pittsburgh, New York, Philadelphia, and other cities. The whole intent being to put all American labor on a get basis, which must prove the economic damnation of the country. And that, apparently, is the end sought, as in Russia. Until Jews can show that the infiltration of foreign Jews and the Jewish idea into the American labor movement has made for the betterment in character and estate, in citizenship and economic statesmanship, of the American working man, the charge of being an alien, destructive, and treasonable influence will have to stand. The last place the uninstructed observer would look for traces of Jewish influence is in the Christian church. I hope you're listening here. Yet, if he failed to look there, he will miss much. If the libraries of our theological seminaries were equipped with complete files of Jewish literary effort in the United States during the past 15 years, and if theological students were required to read these Jewish utterances, there would be less silly talk and fewer easy marks for Jewish propaganda in the American pulpit. For the next 25 years, every theological seminary should support a chair for the study of modern Jewish influence and the protocols of the Elders of Zion. The fiction that the Jews are an Old Testament people faithful to the Mosaic law would then be exploded, and timid Christians would no longer superstitiously hesitate to speak the truth about them because of that sadly misinterpreted text. I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. Or, put another way, as probably most of you have heard it, those who bless Israel shall be blessed, and those who curse Israel shall be cursed. Well, we were waiting. We were certainly waiting to see whether Henry and his editors would find this and hit on this thread about Jews and the myth of them being the chosen people and being people of the book, people of the scripture, all that BS, and they have finally hit it. Good for them. Continuing on. There is a mission for the pulpit to liberate the church from what the New Testament scriptures call the fear of the Jews. The pulpit also has the mission of liberating the church from the error that Judah and Israel are synonymous. The reading of the scriptures, which confuse the tribe of Judah with Israel, and which interpret every mention of Israel as somehow signifying the Jews, is at root of more than one half the confusion and division traceable in Christian doctrinal statements. The Jews are not the chosen people, though practically the entire church has succumbed to the propaganda which declares them to be so. The Jewish tinge of thought has of late years overspread many Christian statements, and the uninstructed clergy have proved more and more amenable to Jewish suggestion. The flaccid condition of the church, so much deplored by spokesmen who had regard for her inner life, was brought about not by science, not by scholarship, not by the increase of light and learning, for none of these things are antagonistic even to incomplete statements of truth, but by Jewish-German higher criticism. The defenders of the faith have fought long and valiantly against the inroads made by the so-called higher criticism, but were sadly incapacitated in their defense because they did not see that its origin and purpose were Jewish. It was not Christian. It was not German. It was Jewish. It is almost wholly discounted today in the practical life of the church, but it still adheres to the darker corners of the colleges, along with the Red Bolshevism, which is taking root there under Jewish influences. Let the Christian minister who wishes to know the source of Jewish influence in the church look over the names of the more notorious, supposedly German, higher critics of the Bible and consider their race. Add to them one Frenchman, an atheist and a Jew, and you have modern liberal sources very complete. Wellhausen, Strauss, Ewald, Kuhn, Hitzig, and Renan. It is perfectly in keeping with the Jewish World Program that this destructive influence should be sent out under Jewish auspices, and it is perfectly in keeping with non-Jewish trustfulness to accept the thing without looking at its source. A great many so-called liberals played the Jewish game for a time, and they are now coming back to the old citadel which has stood in its own strength and without their patronage, while the fever of the higher criticism raged. The church is now victim of a second attack against her in the rampant socialism and Sovietism that have been thrust upon her in the name of flabby and unmoral theories of brotherhood and in an appeal to her fairness. The church has been made to believe that she's a forum for discussion and not a high place for enunciation. She has been turned from a voice into an echo of jangling cries. Jews have actually invaded, in person and in program, hundreds of American churches with their subversive and impossible social ideals, and at last became so cocksure of their dominion and domination of the situation that they were met with the inevitable check. Clergymen ought to know that 7/8 of the economic mush they speak from their pulpit is prepared by Jewish professors of political economy and revolutionary leaders. They should be informed that the economic thought has been so completely Judaized by means of a deliberate and masterly plan of camouflaged propaganda that the mass thought of the crowd, which is the thought mostly echoed in popular pulpits and editorials, is more Jewish than Jewry itself holds. The Jew has got hold of the church in doctrine, in liberalism, so-called, and in the feverish and feeble sociological diversions of many pulpits and adult classes. If there is any place where a straight study of the Jewish question should be made, with the Bible always in hand as the authoritative textbook, it is in the modern church, which is unconsciously giving allegiance to a mass of Jewish propaganda. It is not reaction that is counseled here. It is progress along with constructive paths, the paths of our forefathers, the Anglo-Saxons, who have to this day been the world builders, the makers of cities and commerce and continents, and not the Jews who have never been builders or pioneers, who have never peopled the wilderness, but who move in upon the labors of other men. They are not to be blamed for not being builders and pioneers, perhaps. They are to be blamed for claiming all the rights of the pioneers. But even then, perhaps, their blame ought not to be so great as the blame that rests upon the sons of the Anglo-Saxons for rejecting the straightforward building of their fathers and taking up with the doubtful ideas of the Jews. Colleges are being constantly invaded by the Jewish idea. The sons of the Anglo-Saxons are being attacked in their very heredity. The sons of the builders, the makers, are being subverted to the philosophy of the destroyers. Young men in the first exhilarating months of intellectual freedom are being seized with promissory doctrines, the source and consequences of which they do not see. There is a natural rebelliousness of youth which promises progress. There's a natural venturesomeness to play free with ancient faiths, both of which are ebullitions of the spirit and significant of dawning mental virility. It is during the periods when these adolescent expansions are in process that the youth is captured by the influences which deliberately lie in wait for him in the colleges. True, In after years, a large portion come to their senses sufficiently to be able to sit on the fence and see themselves go by. And they come back to sanity. They find that free love doctrines make exhilarating club topics, but that the family, the old-fashioned loyalty of one man and one woman to each other and their children, is the basis not only of society, but of all personal character and progress. They find that revolution, while a delightful subject for fiery debates and an excellent stimulant to the feeling of Superman-likeness, is nevertheless not the process of progress. Let me stop. Wow, this is incredible. This is a very powerful paragraph here. Henry and his editors completely summed up the 1960s and the liberal college experience. And I don't know, they saw it back then. Apparently it was around back then. It's incredible. That's incredible. This is almost 100 years old, and it's just as true today as it was then, probably. Wow. Continuing on. And two, or also, they come at length to see that the stars and stripes in the free republic are better far than the red star in Soviet sordidness. When a Supreme Court justice addressed one of the greater American universities, a student came to him after the lecture and said, "It gave me so much pleasure to hear your lectures, for they were the first kindly words I have heard said about our government since the commencement of my university career." For years, the secular magazines have been carrying articles on the question, "What's wrong with the colleges?" The answer is perfectly clear to those who can discern Jewish influence in American life. The trouble with the colleges has progressed along precisely the same lines that have been described above in connection with the churches. First, Jewish higher criticism in the destruction of the young men's sense of respect for ancient foundations. Second, Jewish revolutionary social doctrines. The two always go together. They cannot live apart. They are the fulfillment of the protocol's program to split non-Jewish society by means of ideas. Powerful. Powerful. So right on the money. I'm thinking here that the Jewish higher criticism, what we've referred to in this article as the German Jewish higher criticism, I think he's specifically talking about the Frankfurt School of socialism, Marxism, communism. I think that was in existence at this time, 1921, 1922. I'm almost certain of it. I think that's specifically what he's talking about. And if he is, my God, this man, the editors and Henry, whoever particularly wrote this piece, is right on the money. Incredible. Continuing on. It is idle to attack the unbelief of college students. It's idle to attack their radicalism. These are always the qualities of immaturity. But it is not idle to show that social radicalism here being a very good word, very sadly misused, and antagonism to the religious sanctions of the moral law, both come from the same source. Over the fountain of revolutionism and anti-Christian belief, place the descriptive and definitive term Jewish, and let the sons of the Anglo-Saxons learn from what waters they are drinking. That source is not Mosaic, but Jewish. There is a world of difference between them. Boy, this is hitting on all cylinders, in my opinion, with what they're getting at here. Let the Anglo-Saxons learn from what waters they are drinking. There's scriptures that match those phrases quite well. The central groups of red philosophers in every university is a Jewish group, with often enough a Gentile front in the shape of a deluded professor. Some of these professors are in the pay of outside red organizations. They are intercollegiate socialist societies swarming with Jews and Jewish influences and toting Jewish professors around the country, addressing medics and lits and even the divinity schools under the patronage of the best civic and university auspices. Student lecture courses are fine pasture for this propaganda. Intercollegiate liberal leagues are established everywhere, the purpose evidently being to give students the thrill of believing that they're taking part in the beginning of a great new movement comparable to the winning of the independence or the abolition of slavery. As Stein parties gradually cease as a college diversion, Red conferences will come in. It is part of the effervescence of the youth. The revolutionary forces which head up in Jewry rely very heavily on the respectability which is given their movement by the adhesion of students and a few professors. It was so in Russia. Everyone knows what the name student eventually came to signify in that country. And as a result, while Sovietists are glorifying the success of the revolution, men like Maxim Gorky are sending out appeals for food to prevent the intelligentsia from starving to death. The Jewish Chautauqua, which works exclusively in colleges and universities, together with Bolshevism in art, science, religion, economics, and sociology, are driving straight through the Anglo-Saxon traditions and landmarks of our race of students. And these are ably assisted by professors and clergymen whose thinking has been dislocated and poisoned by Jewish subversive influences in theology and sociology. What to do about it? Simply identify the source and nature of the influence which has overrun our colleges. Let the students know that their choice is between the Anglo-Saxons and the tribe of the Jews, which he writes here, Judah. Not true. Let the students decide, in making up their allegiance, whether they will follow the builders or those who seek to tear down, the destroyers. It is not a case for argument. Radicalism and religious indifferentism are states of mind. Normal men usually grow out of them in good time. Others are caught and held to the end. But the treatment is not argument. The only absolute antidote to the Jewish influence is to call college students back to a pride of race. We often speak of the fathers as if they were the few who happened to affix their signatures to a great document which marked a new era of liberty. The fathers were the men of the Anglo-Saxon Celtic race, the men who came across Europe with civilization in their blood and in their destiny, the men who crossed the Atlantic and set up civilization on a bleak and rock-bound coast, the men who drove west to California and north to Alaska, the men who peopled Australia and seized the gates of the world at Suez, Gibraltar, and Panama. The men who opened the tropics and subdued the Arctics. Anglo-Saxon men who have given form to every government and a livelihood to every people and an ideal to every century. They got neither their God nor their religion from the Jews, nor yet their speech nor their creative genius. They are the ruling people, chosen throughout the centuries to master the world by building it ever better and better, and not by breaking it down. Into the camp of this race, among the sons of the rulers, comes a people that has no civilization to point to, no aspiring religion, no universal speech, no great achievement in any realm but the realm of getting, cast out of every land that gave them hospitality, and these people endeavor to tell the sons of the Saxons what's needed to make the world what it ought to be. If our sons in college follow this counsel of dark rebellion and destruction, it's because they do not know whose sons they are, of what race they are the scions. Let there be free speech to the limit in our universities and free intercourse of ideas, but let Jewish thought be labeled Jewish and let our sons know the racial secret. The warning has already gone out through the colleges. The system of procedure is already fully known, and how simple it is. First, you secularize the public schools. Secularize is the precise word the Jews use for the process. You prepare the mind of the public school child by enforcing the rule that no mention shall ever be made to indicate that culture or patriotism is in any way connected with the deeper principles of the Anglo-Saxon religion. Keep it out, every sight and sound of it. Keep out also every word that will aid any child to identify the Jewish race. Then, when you have thus prepared the soil, you can go into the universities and colleges and enter upon the double program of pouring contempt on all the Christian landmarks, at the same time filling the void with Jewish revolutionary ideas. The influence of the common people is driven out of the public schools, where common people's influence can go. But Jewish influence is allowed to run rampant in the higher institutions where the common people's influence cannot go. Secularize the public schools, and then Judaize the universities. This is the liberalism which Jewish spokesmen so much applaud. In labor unions, in church, in university, it has tinctured the principles of work, faith, and society. This will not be denied, because the proof of it is too thickly written over Jewish activities and utterances. Indeed, it is in exerting these very influences that Jewry convinces itself that it's fulfilling its mission to the world. The capitalism attacked is non-Jewish capitalism. The orthodoxy attacked is Christian orthodoxy. The society attacked is the Anglo-Saxon form of society, all of which, by their destruction, would redound to the glory of Judaism. The list could be extended. The influence of the Jewish idea on Anglo-Saxon sports and pleasure, on the Anglo-Saxon Celtic idea of patriotism, on the Anglo-Saxon Celtic conception of the learned professions, the influence of the Jewish idea runs down through every department of life. Well, one very badly deluded Anglo-Saxon editor wrapped up in Jewish advertising contracts was heard to say, if the Jews can get away with it, then they have a right to. It's a variant of the answer of Jewish origin, which runs thus. How can a paltry 3 million run the 100 million of the rest of us? Nonsense. Yes, let it be agreed. If the Jewish idea is the stronger, if the Jewish ability is greater, let them conquer. Let Anglo-Saxon principles and Anglo-Saxon power go down in ruins before the tribe of the Jews. But let the first two ideas struggle under their own banners. Let it be a fair struggle. It's not a fair fight when in the movies, the public schools, the Judaized churches, and the universities, that the Anglo-Saxon idea is kept away from Anglo-Saxons on the plea that it is sectarian, or it's clannish, or it's obsolete, or something else. It's not a fair fight when Jewish ideas are offered as Anglo-Saxon ideas, because offered under Anglo-Saxon auspices. Let the heritage of our Anglo-Saxon Celtic fathers have free course among their Anglo-Saxon Celtic sons, and the Jewish idea can never triumph over it, in university forum or in the marts of trade. The Jewish idea never triumphs until the first people over whom it triumphs are denied the nurture of their native culture. Jewry has begun the struggle. Jewry has made the invasion. Let it come. Let no man fear it, but let every man insist that the fight be fair. Let college students and leaders of thought know that the objective is the regnancy of the ideas in the race that have built all the civilization we see and that promise all the civilization of the future.
Let them also know that the attacking force is Jewish. That is all that will be necessary. And it is against this that the Jews protest. You must not identify us, they say. You must not use the term Jew. Why? Because unless the Jewish idea can creep in under the assumption of other than Jewish origin, it's doomed. Anglo-Saxon ideas dare proclaim themselves and their origin. A proper proclamation is all that is necessary today. Compel every invading idea to run up its flag. Okay, that's the end of the second half of our episode. This was published on May 21st, 1921. Wow, this the second half of this article is extremely powerful, and I think one of the more memorable ones that we'll probably go through in this entire series. This was excellent, and there's really nothing I can add to this, guys. This is very clear. It's very well known. Most people, this isn't anything new for people on our side of the fence, right? So I'm going to leave it where it is. Until next time, guys, this is Ted Midward signing off for RadioArian.com. Praise Christ. Praise Yahweh. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tuned in to Radio Arian.